It's recording.
What we have at a 4-year term. Okay.
Good to see you, Ken.
Good morning, everyone. The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Thank you for joining us here today. As all of you know, issues relating to sex offender treatment, and specifically the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, has been in the news lately. Believe it or not, this committee hearing was anticipated and scheduled before all of the news articles hit, because we knew at the conclusion of the legislative session last spring that the issue was going to come before us and going to have to be addressed this next legislative session in spring of 2014. So we intended to have a hearing to lay a foundation of knowledge and education for this committee to be able to address the very difficult constitutional and public safety and policy issues based on education and facts, and hopefully not hyperbole and grandstanding, because these issues deserve very serious attention. And there's a coming together of some very important principles in this discussion, principles embodied in our Constitution, that we don't engage in preventive detention in the United States. We don't imprison people because we think that sometime in the future they might commit a crime. On the other hand, we're dealing with a population that often has a history of recidivism and poses a risk of some undetermined amount to the public safety, and most of them have already served their criminal sentences, their debt to society, their punishment for whatever crimes they did commit. And the confluence of these factors make for very difficult public policy choices. It is my intent and my hope that this committee will address these issues in a manner to which the Senate and the Judiciary Committee should be accustomed, which is with seriousness of mind and purpose, and focus on facts and details and information, and on solving this very difficult public policy problem. In order to accomplish that, we have engaged today's hearing, which will give us some background, historical overview of how we came to have the kind of sex offender treatment program and system that we have in Minnesota, and some background relating to the criminal aspects of sex offenses in Minnesota as well. It's intended that this session will be informational, that we will have an opportunity to engage in some discussion and ask questions of the experts who will be appearing before us to provide this testimony, and also that it will help lay some informational foundation for the public who are more tuned in to this issue now than they might have been a month ago. And as we move forward with the task force report due out in a couple of weeks, we'll certainly become more and more tuned in when we engage the issue more directly in our policy making. And so while the task force doesn't have its report prepared, I don't intend to get into specifics relating to whatever that forthcoming report will be, we do have, of course, the task force co-chair with us, who will be, or chair here with us, who will be making a presentation today. I will note that we do have a committee hearing anticipated the week of January 12th to specifically take a look at the task force recommendations and how we might start formulating legislation to respond to it and perhaps adopt some or all of the recommendations as well. And that hearing will be held jointly with the Senate Human Services Committee, chaired by Senator Sharon, who serves on this committee. So it's good to have the overlap as well, because we're going to need all of the best and brightest minds and efforts on this issue. That said, it's our plan today to have about an hour's worth of testimony, then open the floor up for discussion as well, and certainly among the committee members. If you think that the question that you have might be addressed by a testifier that has not yet appeared, if you could hold your question for that time, maybe it'll be answered in the presentation. But I do want the committee members to feel comfortable. If you have a question that comes up on the topic that the presenter is giving, by all means, go ahead and ask the question while it's fresh in your mind so that you can get a full understanding of what is going on. So with that said, I'd like to welcome Robin Benson to the testifiers table. Mr. Benson is the Deputy General Counsel for Direct Care and Treatment at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. I'll start out where the focus of my presentation is kind of how we got here. And looking back briefly at the history of sex offender civil commitment in Minnesota, with more particular attention on what I call the modern era, starting in the 1990s. So we've had sex offender civil commitment in Minnesota since 1939. We are one of the only states that have had some form of continuous civil commitment for sex offenders since that time. Other states, it had to come into fashion in the 30s and 40s, dropped out of fashion, if you can use that word, in the 60s and 70s, and then beginning in 1990 when Washington State enacted its civil commitment law, kind of came back into vogue. So there's that pre-modern era, then there's this modern era that is going to be the focus of things. I divide that into three time periods, the time period of 1990 to 2003, which I describe as getting them in. Well, there's lots of questions about can we use sex offender civil commitment to prolong the custody of individuals who have high risk to society after their incarceration time. Then there's the period that I describe as the surge from 2003 to 2011 in which there's was a dramatic increase in the number of individuals being civilly committed and all of the issues attendant to that. And then finally, I think the current time period that we're in is whether sex offender civil commitment in Minnesota is sustainable. And that's 2011 to the question mark. So beginning in 1939, Minnesota, the legislature and governor enacted the psychopathic personality law. Before that, there had been laws regarding people with mental illnesses, but not one specifically targeted towards those who have tendencies and actions toward others of a sexual nature. Immediately, that was challenged in court. It was enacted April 21st, and the first Supreme Court opinion was issued June 30th. Things moved quite rapidly then, as they do now. The Minnesota Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of it. There were several challenges to that. It upheld it in all respects. It was appealed to the United States Supreme Court, and again, pretty quick turnaround time for a decision for a case to reach that court and be argued and have a decision issued in February of the next year affirming the constitutionality of that act. Jumping forward to the modern era, where the issue was more squarely presented. Before 1990, the psychopathic personality law was used primarily as a diversion from incarceration. So an individual was identified as having the issues and the danger to others, and rather than incarcerating them, the individual, and I think maybe some slides got skipped. No? Okay. So as a diversion from incarceration, beginning in 1990 is when it was being used as an addition to incarceration to, so to speak, hold on to people after they've served their prison time. So this graphic from the 1994 Legislative Auditor's Report illustrates that dramatic increase and the relative sparse use of it prior to that. So from 1970 to 1993, we have some years where there were no petitions or no civil commitments under this category at all. Then we have a slight uptick in the late 80s, and slight uptick meaning one or two a year. And then in 1991, we're in double digits. In 92, we're in more double digits, and we have taken off since then. And that's the use of the old psychopathic personality law. With that uptick, legislative action was not far behind, particularly bonding action, which provided for a 100-bed facility in Moose Lake, Minnesota, for a psychopathic personality treatment center. So that was in that was actually authorized in 1992, and then the expansion with the bed space was 93. 1994 is a watershed year in terms of the modern era of civil commitment in Minnesota. In January, the Minnesota Supreme Court narrowly upheld a psychopathic personality commitment of Philip Blodgett in a 4-3 decision. And in that decision, there was some question cast on the ability to use the psychopathic personality statute for civil commitment. It was not a shadow cast in terms of would the psychopathic personality statute be unconstitutional. It was more of would it be used in these newer cases that prosecutors were bringing, trying to kind of increase the catchment of the psychopathic personality law. In February, the legislative auditor issued a report on the psychopathic personality law, preparing the legislature at that time had seen things coming and wanted to get more information, so the legislative auditor provided that. Then on June 30th, the state Supreme Court issued two decisions, the more famous of which is involving Dennis Linehan, in which it reversed the civil commitment of individuals under that law, saying that they did not meet the criteria for civil commitment. Not long after that, August 31st, in special session, the legislature enacted the Sexually Dangerous Person Law, which did not replace the psychopathic personality law. It supplemented it with a different category and different criteria for civil commitment. As I mentioned, this was a time period when other states were also enacting civil commitment laws, and undoubtedly they were being challenged just as in Minnesota. Cases from Kansas were the ones that reached the Supreme Court. So in 1997 and 1992, the United States Supreme Court addressed these what were called sexually violent predator laws and upheld the laws in Kansas, and many states patterned theirs after the Kansas law. And during this time, Minnesota's law was being challenged in the Linehan series of cases. And what happened there was Linehan was petitioned for commitment under the new law because he had not met the criteria according to the Supreme Court under the old law. Immediately appealed that. That went to our state Supreme Court, which upheld the commitment and upheld the law to challenges to its constitutionality. The United States Supreme Court granted review but held it because it had already granted review in the Kansas case, decided the Kansas case, remanded back to the Minnesota Supreme Court for it to consider its Linehan holding in light of that, and our court, based on Hendricks, upheld the law. But that wasn't the end of it in Minnesota. There was further challenges. Linehan had an Eighth Circuit habeas case challenging the application of the law. So it really wasn't until 2003, after the second United States Supreme Court case and also the Eighth Circuit denied Mr. Linehan's habeas appeal, that there was something to be described as kind of a settled feeling around the question of can civil commitment be used to continue to manage sex offenders. Then just as things had gotten settled down, law-wise, there was what I describe as the surge. So this graph represents the number of referrals from the Department of Corrections to county attorneys. The referrals take place, the mechanism for the referral is that when an individual who is serving time for certain convictions or has certain background convictions is about to be released, the Department of Corrections reviews their case through a very rigorous process and identifies whether that individual, whether a petition for civil commitment may be appropriate for them. And they've been doing that since 90 or 91. And through the 1990s, as we see the second half in the graph, there had been some activity around that. Those are the referrals, not the commitments. And then just in December of 2003, which is just after the incident involving Drew Shadeen occurred, we have 235 referrals being made to county attorneys. And then since then, a much different rate of referral going to county attorneys and a much different rate of petitioning for civil commitment occurring after that time. And the result of that...
Mr. Benson?
Yes.
Does your presentation include a brief synopsis of what that process is?
It wasn't, but I can describe it.
Can you give us just a few minutes of what that involves?
Sure. So when the individual is coming toward their supervised release date, so in Minnesota, the law is that they serve two-thirds of their sentenced time in incarceration. So when they're getting close to that two-thirds of their sentence, the Department of Corrections has identified them based on their either current conviction or, I believe, also any other convictions they may have, and does screening. So we'll have a forensic psychologist look at their file, perhaps do an interview. We'll identify the risk factors that they have and identify whether this individual would be appropriate for civil commitment. That process also includes an independent counsel who provides another perspective or another view of that. And then the output of that is a referral in the cases where they believe civil commitment may be appropriate, a referral to the county attorney. And then it's up to the county attorney to decide whether to petition for civil commitment. The county attorney has different kinds of information than available to the Department of Corrections. They're likely the ones who prosecuted the individual for their offense that they're serving time on. We'll know if there are victims available for testimony, kind of be able to make an evaluation of whether it's a winnable case if they were to take it to court. Now, the DOC screening process is not the only way that someone is not a prerequisite to being petitioned for civil commitment. If an individual is not referred by the DOC, but the county attorney knows of them, or is not an adult offender coming out of DOC, so they may be coming out of Red Wing as a juvenile who's aged out, or they may be otherwise in the community, the county attorney is free to, as long as they have a good cause to believe that the individual meets commitment criteria, to petition that individual for civil commitment. So that's how the petitioning process works.
Mr. Benson, when they petition, is that in the district court? And what's the judicial process then?
It is filed in the district court in the county where the individual has residence, or if they're coming out, or where the last offense occurred. So it could be where they had been a resident, or if they had offended in a different county where that last offense occurred. So it is in district court. It's venued before a district court judge who, it's a court of general jurisdiction. There's no specialization, although in Ramsey County and Hennepin County, they do have judges who sit on the probate bench who don't exclusively do sex offender civil commitments or hear sex offender civil commitments, but they do exclusively deal with mental health and other probate issues. So they do, in those counties, have a little more specialization.
Mr. Chair.
My questions, raise any questions? Yes, Senator Ortman.
To what do you attribute the surge? Is that more prosecutors taking advantage of a tool, or are there more offenders that are qualifying for civil commitment, or are there more sentences for sex offenders?
Well, there was no change in – oh, sorry. Mr. Chair, Senator, there was no change in the criteria, in the statutory criteria for civil commitment. It was – most attributable to prosecutors, Department of Corrections individuals identifying more people as being suitable for civil commitment. And even though there were more referrals and more petitions filed, not all of those individuals were civilly committed. As the graph shows, there was certainly an uptick in the number of individuals coming to MSOP, but not all of the individuals referred for commitment were petitioned for commitment. Not all who were petitioned for commitment were committed, but it's logical to have an uptick in commitment when there's an uptick in the pool of people being looked at. So with the surge.
Hold on, please.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Benson, my concern is the role of or not necessarily the role, but the pre-prosecutorial point on the timeline. Are we noticing anything in a cultural difference that is triggering more activity in this type of crime? Have we noticed anything like that, or is it purely something after the fact and it's more of a bureaucratic issue of how we are putting more people into the MSOP program?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I don't have kind of refined knowledge on it, but I do understand that the overall rate of criminal behavior in society has decreased since the 1990s. Part of that is the demographics of society. It's getting older, fewer younger people. Along with that, there has been a decrease in the level of sexual offenses being committed and convicted. And I just don't have the depth of knowledge to be able to describe what the trends might predict for the future, other than there has been some decrease in that.
Right.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mr. Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With the increase in population at MSOP, there was the attendant increase in issues related to that growth. So in June of, at the end of June in 2003, the number of MSOP clients stood at 199. Today, it is 698. So there's been roughly a tripling or more over the 10 years since 2003. A lot of that increase came quite quickly after December of 2003, one year having an increase of 99 clients alone. Now, remember, the MSOP Moose Lake facility had been bonded for 100 beds. There had been additional expansion in 1999 or 2000 to add another 50 beds, so 150, but certainly not enough to keep pace with the increase in population. With that, the issues during this surge period for MSOP, in addition to providing treatment for any individual who elected to participate in treatment, there's the issue of finding bed space, finding dining space, ensuring the protection of the public through a secure treatment facility. So there was quite a bit of activity going on during this time period affecting the program overall. And, of course, having sometimes 100 new clients each year and having to do the hiring caused a relatively unstable atmosphere. Now, within that atmosphere, there's also heightened security concerns. In 2005 and 2006 were the first and only escapes from the program. They were at the St. Peter campus. The individuals were later apprehended, but certainly that brought to the forefront people's concerns about security with this facility and this population. This is an aerial view of the Moose Lake facility. This is an older picture. It doesn't show the recent construction, but to the right, the structure that has multiple wings, that was bonded in, I believe, 2006. That's a 400-bed facility, more of a correctional model in terms of its floor plan with 68 and 90-some bed units compared to the original design of 25 bed units at the main building. The big area that has lots of dirt at that now is the housing support area that has vocational programming, education, treatment space, dining facilities, and that was completed not too long ago. But it wasn't until, I believe, 2009 that the new construction for beds was completed. Before that time, MSOP was renting bed space at the DOC facility that's in the upper left part of the screen. So there was just a lot of turmoil around just the physical plant and structure of the program at that time. Now, this is the population projection. It used to be that 2018 bar used to go up to just over 1,000, but there's been some tapering off in the rate of commitments, such that now the projection is that by 2018, under the current law and current practices, meaning status quo, we will reach just about 1,000 individuals committed to MSOP in the facility population.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Mr. Benson, the surge seems to be going up, and my question is, do we have the psychologists behind this? Can somebody tell us why? I mean, what's happening in our culture? What do we see the things that are causing the surge to continue to grow? And if so, are we planning, and maybe that's the perspective we have to come up with, are we planning for larger facilities, more facilities, or, you know, that's a big concern.
Mr. Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hall, I don't know what the cultural attributes are, although I think it is important to remember that the individuals who are being civilly committed in 2013 oftentimes committed their crimes in the early 2000s, the 1990s. It is because they're coming out of their correctional time that they are being – is the point at which they're being considered for civil commitment. So whatever it says about I think the economist would call it a lagging indicator, if there were such for social norms and social things. In terms of the trend of commitment, it's largely because people are not getting out of MSOP. We have a program that is only growing, and it is probably no surprise and shouldn't be any surprise that the decrease in population only occurs if an individual passes away or is provisionally discharged, or for at least a temporary respite from the population growth. Some individuals violate their Department of Corrections conditions of release, and they're sent back to the Department of Corrections, but then they are going to be coming back because they're serving an indeterminate commitment. In terms of kind of bending the curve so that it's not quite so dramatic, something that doesn't get talked about a lot and something that I don't necessarily know a lot about is prevention. That all of these individuals have victimized people before they were in prison, before they came on the radar. The extent that society can prevent those from occurring, it's going to prevent not only victims, but also individuals who are going to be spending most of their lives in a state facility.
Senator Rotman.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Benson. I know that we're going to hear from the sentencing guidelines folks, but I want to know generally if you know if sentences were longer or shorter prior to the surge. It would seem to me that now that there was a new tool and people could be civilly committed, perhaps the sentences were shorter. Is that the case?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, I'll leave the specific answer to Ms. Mitchell on that. In general, though, as I mentioned, this is a civil commitment is a lagging indicator of sentencing practices or reflector of it, in that the individuals who were being civilly committed in the early 1990s when commitment was first being looked at, a lot of them committed their crimes in the 70s and 80s. And I believe it was in the beginning of the 80s when we moved to determinate sentencing. And so that was, I think, one of the factors in looking at civil commitment, because individuals were not coming out and there was no correctional ability to continue supervision any longer. Now, some states that have both use both civil commitment and a blend of sentencing practices to manage offenders, many states don't have civil commitment at all, and they use extended sentencing or extended conditions such as lifetime registration, lifetime supervision, not just registration, but they have a parole officer or a probation officer for their lifetime, and they use other measures for managing individuals short of continuing their confinement within the walls that are operated by the state.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
I just wonder if in the future, I don't think it's happening today, looking at my agenda here, that we might hear from psychologists. I think that might help us to look at what we're doing, and then are there some preventative things that can be done?
So noted.
Senator Glass.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I agree that prevention really is an important piece of all of changing trends, but I just want to make sure I understood what you were saying, Mr. Benson, that what we're looking at is all the existing population and its trends, and then trying to understand why the trend is upward. So in a typical system where people were being admitted, there also would be discharge. So if you had an equivalent movement through the system, out of the system as you have into the system, we would see a very different picture here. So a major factor is the fact that nobody is coming out of the system, that these numbers are continuing to grow. So when we take a look at is there more crime or is there more shorter stays in those really may, in fact, impact that 75, 50 to 75 coming into the system. But it really does not help us appreciate what the failure to move people through the system does in terms of this trend line. Would you agree with that statement?
Mr. Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would, Senator. It is certainly, we have both front-end issues in terms of the frequency of petitions and the number that are coming into MSOP. We also have, obviously, the issue of people coming out of MSOP. It was designed as a treatment program, and one of the pillars of civil commitment and the justification under the Constitution is that it's designed to treat individuals so that they reduce their risk to society so that they can be safely reintegrated into society. That doesn't mean that the only management can occur when they're within the walls of a state facility. Management often also occurs, and in other states occurs, when they are in the community through supervision such as GPS, registration, continued supervision by probation and corrections officials.
Senator Lyons.
Senator Sherman.
And then just to make sure I'm clear, that if we're talking about trend lines in terms of sexual crime, sexual behavior, cultural kinds of things, or actions on the part of the courts for commitment, if that's increased, that they're committing more, it really is the slide that you gave us on just after the modern era, I think that really gives us a better trend line, correct, in terms of what's happening in on the commitment side. The graph we were just looking at is the total population and the fact that it just keeps growing and doesn't decrease. But this is the one that shows us what's happening in terms of the civil commitment and the projections that you have about that. So can you say, if I look at this, after 2003, which is the Drew Shadeen incident, and Department of Corrections, I think, changed its practice and referred more back to the counties at that time for consideration. So we saw this surge of the number of persons committed. But that looks like that trend line is pretty stable. Would you agree with that?
Mr. Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sherman. It is a trend that is stabilized in a at a higher level than obviously what we saw before.
That's right.
November 2003.
Senator Dietzick.
He answered it. Thank you.
All right.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Limmer.
Just so I can be a part of this flurry of questions, I wanted to know, of the population that's in the civil commitment population, how many individuals are there that never received a criminal trial, prison sentence of any kind, that are just a direct civil commitment? Are there any?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I don't have the detailed information. I do know anecdotally there are some individuals who were committed under the psychopathic personality law. When it was in the 70s and 80s, when it was more of a diversionary practice, that either were duly committed, so had a correctional sentence at the same time they had the indeterminate civil commitment, or did not receive a correctional sentence at the time that they were in front of the court. Currently, the only significant subset of the MSP population that would not have adult convictions would be individuals whose offense history was exclusively when they were juvenile, and I believe the numbers there are about 50 to 52 individuals were civilly committed to MSOP based on activity that was not did not result in adult convictions.
Mr. Chair, do we have a number? Do you have a number, an estimated number of how many out of the 600-some population that we're looking at?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I do not have that number other than the 50 to 52 that have the juvenile histories only. We could research that and find that out for you.
And Mr. Chair, one other question I had is anyone that has had a history or triggered an event to be committed civilly for sex offenses, are there ever any individual that just simply bypasses the MSOP program and simply put in the general population of the St. Peter facility, someone that would be considered not amenable to any treatment. They're just so far, so extreme that that type of program would not be the appropriate one for them or for the safety of the public.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, there are individuals who are civilly committed in different categories of civil commitments, mentally ill and dangerous, for example, who do have sexual offending behavior in their backgrounds, but they're not civilly committed as sexually dangerous persons or sexual psychopathic personalities. That may have been more the case prior to the modern era than it is now. With the sexually dangerous persons law, prosecutors are able to obtain commitments through that. There are a handful of individuals, maybe a dozen to two dozen in MSOP, who are duly committed as mentally ill and dangerous and as either a psychopathic personality or a sexually dangerous person. So it's a relatively small number. In terms of someone being placed who is totally unamenable to treatment, there are individuals who have developmental disabilities who, the cognitive ability to benefit from current treatment is impaired. It's not to say that they are not treatable or that their risk cannot be reduced through some form of intervention, and that does take place, and there are individuals who struggle with treatment, struggle with their ability to engage in treatment, but still try very hard, and treatment providers work with them to ensure that whatever benefit they can obtain, they do obtain.
I would note in response to Senator Limmer's comments that that surge in December 2003, at least some portion of that surge line were persons that had already served their correctional time, were living out in the community. And in response to the Drew Shadeen incident, in fact, that one, if memory serves, Mr. Rodriguez had served his correctional time, had not been committed to the state sex offender program, was living in the community. And then he went and committed the offense against Drew Shadeen. So I think there were a lot of factors that came together at that point. Clearly, you can't avoid the fact there was a public outcry, and rightly so, concern about individuals out in the community that posed a greater risk than perhaps the authorities had recognized or taken action on beforehand. And so those of us in this room who were here longer than me, actually, who can recall Senate Judiciary Committee hearings when the Department of Corrections was up here and the senators were saying, how come you aren't committing more people? How come you aren't reviewing more people? So there's certainly, you can't divorce this from the politics of the community as well as the very real substantive analysis of who ought to be committed and who should not be committed. So I think there's more attention paid. And then when DOC refers more people that perhaps they hadn't looked at as carefully before or didn't think would meet the criteria, they get referred to county attorneys who also have a variety of pressures, not only the professional obligations, but they're elected officials in their counties. And then when they do choose to refer a case into district court, the judges, most of whom are in counties where they're living among all of the people that come before them and everyone else, and judges are elected in Minnesota too. So there are a variety of pressures that I think came together to bring more people into the system for analysis when the decision was to be made, should they be committed, do they meet the statutory criteria or not. And I think that probably accounts for some of the surge. Those who are in prison and soon to be released and those who are already out in the community, but perhaps there was heightened attention to the risks they may pose even if they hadn't recommitted in those situations. And you probably see then the trend lines in those categories continue down the road. Am I saying anything that rings not true, Mr. Benson? I'm happy to be corrected if I'm off
base. No, Mr. Chair, and actually I appreciate your clarification because that is indeed what the case was. There was no no known increase in the rate of crime or anything other than the pool of individuals that could be considered for civil commitment. The state looked deeper into that pool when it was looking for candidates for civil commitment.
I will also note, I've been handed a note by our CRAC staff that there are some statistics in the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report in 2011 on the civil commitment of sex offenders that may answer some of these questions. It is available online, and our staff will send a link out to the Senate offices as well, in case you wish to look at that. Any other questions or comments at this time? Mr. Benson, why don't you go on?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. What I tell people is that sex offender civil commitment is not just an issue that confronts the Department of Human Services, the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, or individual victims or individual prosecutors. It affects Minnesota. And this graphic illustrates where MSOP's clients come from. We have 87 counties, and 80 of those counties have individuals within MSOP at this time. It is a Minnesota issue, and in terms of the proportions, you would think, oh, the metro area, they must have everyone. Well, it's actually relatively evenly split in terms of the metro counties have around half of the committed individuals in MSOP, and then the rest of Minnesota accounts for the other half. It's really not something that's only an urban issue. It affects everyone in Minnesota and all counties in Minnesota. Entering the modern era, what I think the issue here is whether Minnesota can sustain sex offender civil commitment as a means of managing sex offenders and preventing further sexual violence. And again, it's Minnesota's sex offender program. Some of the kind of quick facts are that from 2008 forward, MSOP has had stable clinical and operational leadership. That had not been the case during the surge. There had been a lot of turnover, a lot of issues just dealing with staffing and leadership. Since 2008, there's been a high rate of treatment participation among clients and clients progressing through different phases of treatment. You don't necessarily see that on the back end of things. And one would think it's counterintuitive for an individual to engage in treatment when, quote, nobody's gotten out, and what's the incentive for participating in treatment. Yet, consistently, it's in the mid 85 to 84% range of individuals who are participating in treatment in MSOP, which really attests to the motivation of many of those individuals and also the motivation and creativity of staff who are continuing to provide treatment and engage individuals who have oftentimes difficult histories and difficult paths out in treatment. In March of 2012 was the first provisional discharge in over a decade. It was actually the second one since MSOP came into existence. Oftentimes it's described as only the first. The earlier one, the individual had his provisional discharge revoked. In 2003 or 2013, there were three clients who were recommended for provisional discharge by the Special Review Board. And currently there are 16 clients in this building, Community Preparation Services, which is a highly supervised but unlocked and not behind the razor wire facility at the St. Peter campus, which is the reintegration programming phase of MSOP, where the individuals are preparing for their provisional discharge into the community. If the chair would like, I could describe more of the petitioning process for how someone gets out. I was focusing on the history, but if that would help the members, I could provide a quick...
Would the committee like to have that information?
Sure.
Why don't you take a few minutes and do that.
So in contrast to how someone gets into civil commitment, the way out of it is not through an individual district court judge in a court of general jurisdiction. It is through two specialty bodies. One is the Special Review Board, which is composed of an attorney, a psychiatrist or doctorate-level psychologist, and another mental health professional who are appointed but independent of the commissioner. So when someone wants to receive a reduction in custody, which is either transfer to this building, which is called Green Acres. We inherited the name. We didn't name it that. But the less restrictive setting of Community Preparation Services, that's a transfer. Or provisional discharge, which is the individual is in the community, but they continue to have conditions placed on their liberty, similar to probation or conditional release from corrections. And then there's full discharge. Those are the three types of reductions in custody. That petition first goes to the Special Review Board. They hold a hearing. A forensic psychologist prepares an independent assessment. The treatment team provides a report to the board describing the individual's participation in treatment and offers their opinion on whether they're ready for that reduction in custody. That special review board makes a recommendation to another specialized body called the Judicial Appeal Panel. The Judicial Appeal Panel is composed of three district court judges who are appointed by the Supreme Court Chief Justice, and they sit in a panel of three, and they hear and are the only ones that have actual authority to grant a reduction in custody. If the SRB recommends a grant of a reduction in custody and the county or the commissioner do not object to that, then the Judicial Appeal Panel is able to adopt that recommendation as its own and order that or set it on for hearing. So it's a different process for getting out in terms of the judicial process than it is for being civilly committed, although some of the actors are the same, with the county attorney being involved and, of course, the individual. So that's the brief overview of that part of the process.
Thank you, Mr. Benson.
Yep. And then I'm going to highlight some of the currents. As the chair observed, it's an issue that's gotten some recent attention, and that recent attention has been going on since at least March of 2011, when the legislative auditor issued a report on civil commitment of sex offenders that highlighted some of the issues both within the system and also within MSOP regarding sex offenders. And that was the first time that, or at least the most recent time, that we've had a something with the state seal on it, critical of some of the aspects of civil commitment and identifying some of the issues within that area. That led to what is often referred to as the federal case. It is Karstens et al. Versus Jessen et al. It is a class action. It was certified last summer as a class action for injunctive relief. It started out as a number of pro se lawsuits, all of them pointing out, look at the legislative auditor's report, look at the legislative auditor's report, and then about 14 clients at MSOP got together and put all their names on one of those complaints, and that got the attention of the federal court, which appointed or sought pro bono counsel for them, and that's that leads to many other things. But the claims that they're making in that litigation are that there's inadequate treatment, the conditions of confinement are punitive, and that the one that probably causes the eyes to widen the most would be that 253B, or now it's 253D after recodification, is unconstitutional, that the civil commitment law itself should be struck down. The current status of the lawsuit is that we are in discovery. There are also motions that are scheduled. There are some that were scheduled for February 14th. Recently, within the last week, there has been an acceleration of the motion hearing schedule, such that I believe the morning of December 18th is when Judge Frank will be hearing a motion to dismiss, and also motions by plaintiffs that focus on legal questions rather than factual questions. There may or may not be a federal court ruling on at least some of the issues prior to the beginning of session. An outgrowth of the Karstens litigation is the Sex Offender Civil Commitment Advisory Task Force. It originated from the Karstens litigation. It was ordered by Chief Magistrate Judge Boylan and given three tasks: to examine and provide legislative recommendations on the commitment and referral standards and procedures, less restrictive alternatives to secure facility commitment, and the reduction in custody standards and procedures. Looking at those tasks and looking at the litigation, it's evident that the court's purpose or intent was to identify those issues that really are not amenable so much to a to litigation or for the court to create something or to do something, and instead provide the opportunity for the task force, which is a collection of experts from a variety of fields and perspectives, to identify legislative solutions to some of the issues that were being identified. And that task force, of course, is chaired by former Chief Justice Magnuson and co-chaired by former Chief Federal Judge James Rosenbaum. Then last session, as the Senate is aware, as this committee heard the bill going through, there was the Sharon Liebling legislation that provided a number of procedural reforms, not changing any of the substantive standards for commitment or standards for getting out. But that legislation, which was passed in the Senate and did not reach the floor of the House, provided for the development of strict intensive supervision and treatment, which is a less restrictive way of managing sex offenders, not requiring them to be placed in a secure treatment facility, but instead providing a system supervision, treatment, and housing that would ensure their safe residence in the community while receiving treatment and supervision. Provided for a public education campaign, would have bifurcate front-end proceedings to have the district courts and not, of course, not change who hears these cases, but more of how they hear them, so that the first phase of any commitment trial was just you meet the commitment standards, and the second phase being a new one that would rigorously examine where the individual needs to be placed in order to ensure their successful treatment and also the protection of public safety. On the back end, the legislation provides for biennial evaluations and court review of eligibility for reduction in custody. The current system, that SRB judicial appeal panel process, requires the individual to petition for their reduction in custody. Every other state has an automatic review requirement whereby the court or the facility provides an annual, usually it's an annual review of the individual's continued need for civil commitment, and so is placed in front of an independent decision maker much more frequently than in Minnesota. And as I mentioned, it passed in the Senate, and there was no House floor action on that bill. So that concludes what I've prepared. I can certainly stay up here and ask more questions if that would help.
Thank you, Mr. Benson. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to this court case, I have two questions. Can you kind of go over somewhere in here? I think you said there were maybe, three clients recommended by the Special Review Board for provisional discharge. Were they discharged, and can you kind of go over some of the, I'm assuming, I don't know, if do they have GPS monitoring? Do they have to check in? How highly supervised are they? So I believe at least one of them was released. So if you can kind of go over to just kind of alleviate some fears out in the public that they are, I mean, we're just not letting them free and wandering the streets. If you can kind of, other than that has happened in another situation, so we won't go there. And then also on this court case, it concerned me a bit that it's now on this accelerated thing. Can you kind of go over, and I don't know the outcomes, none of us have tea leaves, but I mean, just to kind of let the public know, since we're here in this committee, I mean, there is a chance that the federal court could just say you can't keep them anymore and just open the doors and let everybody out, in which case, am I correct that then do we have any, you know, if that were to happen, I think that's a long shot, but you never know. If that were to happen, do we have any monitoring or continual monitoring of the clients right now?
Mr. Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator.
30 seconds or less.
I'll need more time. In terms of supervision, so there was an individual who was provisionally discharged in March of 2012. The decision was in February, and then he actually entered his placement in March. And he has not reoffended. He has not had any issues. He continues to be supervised. He has moved from his original halfway house situation to more of a group living, a monitored group living situation, given his needs. And then there are three individuals who are currently, their provisional discharge petitions are pending before the judicial appeal panel. In all cases, there are standard provisional discharge conditions that the program requires before it will support the individual's provisional discharge. And in this case, all three individuals are supported by the program. And I should note that many MSOP clients will petition for provisional discharge or full discharge and are not supported by the program because they're not ready in terms of treatment or their behaviors. So for those individuals who are supported, some of the standard conditions of supervision in the provisional discharge plan are things like residence. It's specified where they are. They can't simply walk out and take up any old residence that they want. If their offending history includes children, they're prohibited from being near parks or places where children congregate. Each individual has a reintegration specialist, and at this time, because so few have gotten out, the ratio is essentially 1-to-1 or 1-to-2. They all have active GPS ankle bracelets. Active GPS is essentially real-time monitoring of their locations, and the GPS is programmed so that there are inclusion zones and exclusion zones. So an exclusion zone is a place where they're not supposed to be, and given their continued supervision, they have to present a weekly schedule to their reintegration specialist, and that's how they can identify where they can be or to ensure that the monitoring is consistent with where they need to go for treatment or for other activities. When they are first reach provisional discharge, for the conventional clients, those who don't have any other cognitive issues, they're in a what corrections uses for the halfway houses for transitioning out of correctional environments. They have house rules, they have curfews, they have requirements to not go out the door for a certain period of time. They're visited by their reintegration specialist plus staff at the halfway house. And to put some perspective on it, in terms of recidivism, sex offenders generally have a lower rate of recidivism than other criminals. And the one intervention that studies show reduces that already low rate of recidivism even more is supervision. Supervision in the form of face-to-face contacts, collateral contacts, having GPS. So these individuals are, when they're on provisional discharge, they're not walking out the door with a suitcase trying to find the next bus to anywhere. They are highly managed and highly supervised, so much so that any of us having those conditions imposed on us would feel that all of our rights are being violated and that it's akin to being in prison. For someone who is exiting oftentimes a long period of correctional activity, that structure and that supervision is welcomed oftentimes by them, and it is surely welcomed by the Department of Human Services and the communities in which they are placed.
Senator Deza.
Thank you, Chair. Two things. First of all, my second half of my question, if Judge Magnuson, he may be addressing that on what happens if the court case, so you can defer to him if he's going to address that. But going back to the, so if they are released, the person is released, they have all these conditions, and so if something occurs, then they are, do they go back to MSOP or do they go back to in the criminal system?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it depends on what the behavior is. Certainly if it is new criminal behavior, they can, just as anyone, be charged with that, with a crime. Because the level of supervision is so intense, it is more likely that there would be a violation of the terms of their provisional discharge, what are often called technical violations, meaning that no one was harmed, but we identified their failure to conform with those requirements. And they can be revoked. Their provisional discharge can be revoked immediately and without any notice or warning to the individual, picked up and brought back to a secure facility. If there's any attempt to tamper, if they cut off the GPS bracelet, that's a felony level crime that they'll be apprehended quickly because we have active GPS, and they will likely not be returning to a treatment facility, but will be doing some correctional time. To quickly address the second part of your first question on the acceleration of the lawsuit. I believe that the actual motion papers will be, revised motion papers will be filed tomorrow, so we will see what plaintiffs' actual motions are. In the past, they have moved for a declaration that the Commitment Act is unconstitutional, and they've also asked for the appointment of special masters to essentially run the program. In terms of the odds of those things happening, now I'm speaking as an attorney for the defendant in the case, and I believe that that we do have very strong legal arguments and that we are will be successful. I'm not the judge, though, and I believe that in this particular case there is some risk where the judge may not open the doors and let everyone go, but will do some substantial remodeling of civil commitment in Minnesota. And that, as Chief Justice Magnuson discusses, is not done with a scalpel, is done with a rather more blunt instrument, and I'll let him continue with on that vein if he wants. So I think I've...
Why don't we go ahead then and hear from Chief Justice Magnuson. Mr. Benson, thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
Justice Magnuson, welcome to the committee. We'll note that you're chair of the Sex Offender Civil Commitment Advisory Task Force. That's been doing a lot of work over the last year or so. And we appreciate your work, and we look forward to the report in a couple of weeks. But you're going to give us some additional information on what the task force has been doing.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here. The exact phrase I used was broadsword. Not scalpel. We've provided you with a significant amount of information, and there's a lot more behind that. It has a cover page on it to reflect that I moved to a new law firm, but the materials behind it are those that we distributed last year when we were speaking to the legislature. I think most significant among them is a print of the web page that the task force has maintained, and then we have excerpted certain items that are there so that you have a handy reference. But if you want to delve deeply into the history of civil commitment in Minnesota, there are as many resources on our website as you could possibly want. One thing that comes up a lot in our discussions is, what do other states do? And so we have also tried to include materials there that survey other states and compare Minnesota's process and laws to those of other states. We are one of 20 states that have civil commitment programs. In addition, we have in the materials some pleadings relating to the Karstgens litigation, so you can see exactly what it is rather than rely on a PowerPoint slide. Of course, all of those pleadings are available electronically to your staff as well. Finally, we have in the materials an order from the federal court in Washington in the Touré versus Weston case, where the federal court in Washington did find that, as operated, the sex offender civil commitment program in Washington violated the Constitution. And you can see what the court did there. In Mr. Benson's presentation, he noted that civil commitment of sex offenders has passed constitutional muster, but I would caution you that that is on what is known as a facial challenge. In theory, can you lock someone up constitutionally for a crime they have not yet committed? And the Supreme Court of both Minnesota and the United States have said, well, yes, in theory, as long as you establish that they present a significant danger to the public because of a condition that you will undertake to treat. Treatment is the linchpin for the constitutional validity. And the attack in Karstgens is that, well, it may work in theory. The way you're operating it does not work because nobody gets treated and nobody gets out. And it is, in effect, a life sentence of incarceration when you are civilly committed. My task force is not the first group to examine the problems with MSOP as it is operated. There's a 2005 Governor's Task Force report that is summarized, and you have a link to it in the materials. There's the Office of the Legislative Auditor report, and there is an internal review and recommendation from DHS itself. There are serious issues in how the program currently operates, and they can be summarized basically in people get in, and maybe too many people get into the program, and nobody gets out. That's the core of the constitutional challenge that is before Judge Donovan Frank. And I don't purport to have any idea as to what he will do, but what I can say is he can declare the system unconstitutional. He can order the release of those committed, and he can alternatively direct the state on his schedule to do what he thinks is necessary to make the system more rational and functional. And as I have said to other members of the legislature in the past, if that happens, you will not be in control of either the direction or the cost of the program. You will have to do what a federal judge tells you to do. If you think that federal courts will not act upon their determination that something is unconstitutional, you need only look to California, where because of unconstitutional conditions in the prisons, federal judge told the state of California, fix it. They didn't fix it, and the judge started releasing people. We're talking about committing individuals who have served their time for their criminal offense. We're committing them civilly because we are afraid they may do something bad in the future. And while the public safety concerns are significant, and these are real threats that need to be dealt with, they need to be dealt with in a constitutional fashion. Now, the specific order constituting the task force is in the materials. I think if you look at I think it's around page 75 or 80. You don't really need to do that now, but you can see we have a 20-plus member task force comprised of prosecutors, defense lawyers, judges, mental health professionals, legislators, the Commissioner of Corrections. It is a diverse group that has brought a great deal of experience to the issue of examining three specific points. The order appointing the task force directed us to examine and provide recommended legislative proposals to the commissioner on three topics: the civil commitment and referral process for sex offenders' civil commitment options that are less restrictive than placement in a secure treatment facility, and standards and processes for the reduction in custody for civilly committed sex offenders. The last part of the materials, you have our report from December of last year, where we outline some of the background leading up to the appointment of the task force. We make a number of observations and conclusions based on our studies up to that point in time. And then we make a number of specific recommendations, but those were, as directed by the federal court, only involving less restrictive alternatives. Under current law, a sex offender who is civilly committed is presumptively committed to the most secure facility, Moose Lake. Some persons who are committed need to be in Moose Lake. Others do not, but everyone goes there. And no one really moves beyond Moose Lake or St. Peter because, as we found in our first report, there really aren't the facilities available to move them. No one has really gotten beyond that to start developing facilities where, with treatment and supervision, as Mr. Benson explained, people who have been committed as sex offenders can learn to modify their behavior. They can benefit from treatment. They can experience increased freedom and responsibility, all towards the goal of therapy to make sure that they do not pose a risk to the public as they gain their freedom. It's a complex issue. It is highly emotionally charged. And as you can see from the reaction of the public to the efforts of DHS to transfer a few individuals to a facility in Cambridge, there's a lot of emotion that comes out. Now, our task force has been meeting regularly over the past year. We've been meeting every week over the past months. We have a draft report that is a work in progress. If you have seen it or heard about its contents, I simply want to remind you that it's being redrafted every day. But generally, we are focusing on three areas, or I'm sorry, more than that. We are going to address briefly criminal sentencing, and you'll hear from Ms. Mitchell about that. And I don't want, I'm only the chair of this task force. I do not speak for them. We have a group of very bright, strong-willed individuals who have their opinions on things. But I can tell you that we so far have elected not to focus on sentencing because it seems to be outside of our bailiwick, at least outside of the charge that we were given. But one thing that we have concluded is that treatment in the correctional context while people are at DOC is effective and should not be reduced. We're going to talk about the screening process. One of the things we noted in our first report, and it is clear from the legislative auditor's report, is that, as you saw, the increased rates of referral, there is significant inconsistency across the state as to the rate of referrals for commitment. And we've tried to identify the causes for that and possible solutions. We are looking at the petitioning process itself. Who is the prosecutor? What assistance should they have in terms of making consistent and objective judgments on who should be subject to commitment? We are examining commitment procedures. Right now, as Mr. Benson explained, a commitment petition is filed in the county, in the district court, the county with financial responsibility, and it is decided by the local district court judges. We are examining whether it would be beneficial to modify that process in some ways. The prior reports of the legislative auditor and of the governor's task force recommended a special civil commitment court with statewide jurisdiction, and we're examining that. We are also examining whether the commitment criteria can or should be changed. We have in Minnesota a confluence of statutory and case law provisions that courts are supposed to employ in determining whether someone should be civilly committed. We're going to try to make some recommendations that will help make that more clear, not only for the courts, but for the public and those who are subject to civil commitment. And finally, we are charged by the federal court of making recommendations for changes in the law or procedures with respect to reduction in custody. How do people get out of the civil commitment program? And we will have some specific recommendations in that regard as well. We will have our report by December 1st. I'm going to make sure it gets done because I've had too many meetings. And it is a topic that can be discussed endlessly. It is very complex and very difficult. But at some point in time, somebody's got to make decisions. I was hopeful last session that the legislature would take some action, and the Senate did, the House didn't. But somebody is going to do something to change the process for civil commitment of sex offenders. And if it is not the legislature, it is likely going to be the court. With that, I'm open to any questions you have.
Thank you, Justice Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chief Justice. Regarding the third part of the order again, can you address what the task force is doing to address the third part of the inquiry?
The reduction in custody?
Justice
Police. Mr. Chairman, Senator. We are looking at the procedures by which decisions are made, who makes the decisions, and then what are the factors that they should consider. And I would say that generally our approach to the civil commitment process so far has been to examine how we can best make more consistent across the whole process, people getting in, people moving to different levels of commitment, restriction, and people getting out. And our preliminary thinking, and I don't really want to get too far ahead of this, is that if you have a more robust professional evaluative process, one that is not lawyers and judges but is mental health professionals, that has a greater stature in the process, and that continues not only from the screening part of it initially through decisions to change the placement of individuals, and finally the decision to release them, that you will have a more consistent and a more meaningful and rational process.
Senator Orman.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Chief Justice, I'm concerned that you're not addressing the sentencing issue, and I think that's as part of the problem as anything. I've been here in this Judiciary Committee as long as I've served in the Senate, and this is a problem that's been around for a while. I was here for a hearing many years ago where we had that first set of testifiers who talked about the fact that the mental health professionals were not certifying folks for release. And so this question of the operational viability and constitutionality of the program was brought up many years ago. And I think we should be looking at whether there's also a problem with sentencing, that perhaps our sentences should be longer. And as we talked about before with Mr. Benson, that may be a way to make sure that we don't have so many people being brought back in through a civil commitment process if our intention is that these people might be a risk to public safety. And the answer might be that we should maybe keep these folks longer. And I'm wondering, Mr. Chief Justice, for other states, how does Minnesota fit in terms of a comparison with sentencing for these same kinds of crimes, and has your sex offender task force looked at that?
Justice Magnuson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we have looked at that. In 2005, the legislature enacted mandatory life sentences for certain repeated and egregious offenders. In 2006, the Sentencing Guideline Commission issued a separate sex offender grid that greatly enhanced sentences. We have, as I said, observed that the treatment programs in the Department of Corrections seem to be highly effective, and that it's not just a matter of increasing sentences, but it is a matter also of seeing what you can do, because there will be an end. Unless you make every sex offense a life sentence, that person is going to be released from the Department of Corrections at some point in time. And the question is, what can we do as a society to make sure that they present as small a risk as possible? Increased resources to the Department of Corrections may also be an issue, but the whole question of sentencing guidelines is not only complex, but it is not what the federal court told us to do. And we are a task force that was created by federal court order, And while we will comment on things that impact our decisions, we simply weren't asked, nor do we feel competent to address specifically changes to sentencing. That may be something you folks will have to do, but it's not something we can do.
Sorry, well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Orban, a follow-up.
Yes. Well, I'm concerned after having heard testimony and seen the facts about county attorneys that bring folks back in through the referral system because they're concerned about public safety, and licensed psychologists and psychiatrists that are unwilling to certify some of these folks as safe for release, that we need maybe some other type of response here, and that working to make this sex offender program constitutional through its operation, we should be looking at other alternatives, and maybe that's not just the sentencing guidelines. I'm wondering if your task force has looked at some of these other factors and if there's some way to influence them other than just in changing the release procedures for sex offenders.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, we are not talking just about changing procedures. We are talking about providing more resources on the medical, psychological, evaluative part of it to make that more robust and consistent across the entire process. There are components to the problem that we can't address. Discussions we have talked about whether it's even appropriate to talk about abolishing civil commitment of sex offenders and deal with it as 30 other states do. Again, that's not something the federal court asked us to opine on, and we are not going to. However, we do go so far, at least so far in our draft recommendations, to say that this is but part of a piece, and it is part of the piece of the criminal treatment of sex offenders, and because this is the piece that comes afterwards.
Senator Sherman.
Thank you. The complexity of the conversation often draws us into talking about what other kinds of things we might do. For example, what are we doing to prevent violence in the first place, which is really not a function of your task force. And then we also talk about should we change completely or move away from the civil commitment process that we're using, have indeterminate sentencing, stay within the Department of Corrections, treat within the Department of Corrections. My question is, and my understanding is, that the task force is addressing these 700 or so that are currently have already completed their sentence, so they wouldn't be impacted by any change that we might make into our sentencing guidelines. We can't go back and resentence people that are already done with their time and are in treatment. So it's their civil rights that we're looking at in terms of how we're dealing with 700 persons who've already completed their time and are in the state system, the DHS system. And there are persons who are currently in the Department of Corrections already sentenced under existing sentencing guidelines for sexual crimes. So even if this legislature changes for the future how we deal with sex offenders, we shouldn't confuse that. Is this correct? I'm asking for affirmation or disagreement. That there is still this conversation about how to deal with those currently sentenced and those who are currently, and then will either be released through provisional, through a probationary process through the Department of Corrections, or sent into the current civil commitment process, and those 700 or so that are currently present. That's really what you're focused on, and these other conversations really can cause us to be distracted from that and not remember that we have to address the existing population. That's my understanding. That's why I think we need to proceed with legislation, and I would be interested in your comments on that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sherman, it is not possible to have a discussion about any specific aspect of the civil commitment program without understanding the context. And so while we're not charged, for example, Senator Ortman, with making recommendations concerning changes to sentencing, It doesn't mean that we're unmindful of them and that we don't consider how they might impact the operation of a civil commitment system. Senator Sharon, to your question, we're not only aware of the impact of criminal sentences, but we're aware that we have 700 individuals already subject to the jurisdiction of the MSOP, and our changes need to be mindful not only of new people, the rights of new people being brought into the system, but those that are there and how we get them out. So we have tried to draft our recommendations in a way that will address issues as we see them, not only for the existing population, but for those who are about to come into the process. And if I understood your question, I hope my answer makes sense. Yes, we're aware of that, and it all needs to be considered as part of a larger issue.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sharon.
I just want to follow up. I'm not a lawyer, so it's a legal question. We could change the law. The legislature, as you indicated, it could change and have all of this operated through the Department of Corrections and eliminate civil commitment altogether, as other states have, 30 other states do it. But even if we did that, we cannot go back and resentence people who have already been sentenced under the old law, or...
I believe that that's true.
Yeah.
We can't change
a sentence once already given. They have given a sentence. So we have a group that we have to address under the current process, even though we may do some additional things in changing future civil commitment law, and we may make some major investments in trying to do prevention programs. But we can get lost a little bit, I think, and I don't think they are unimportant conversations, but my understanding of the law is we can't go and undo what we've done with current existing sexual crimes and their convictions and those who are currently in the DHS system, and we have to have a constitutionally defensible way of dealing with that group of people.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, speaking only in my capacity as an individual and not as a former judge or chair of the commission, I believe you're right. I think that we can't, as to the people who are in MSOP now, say, well, let's just extend their criminal sentence if we can't keep them here constitutionally. That's not permissible. We have to. That could be a future solution for future people. The folks that are there need to be treated in a constitutional manner, so there have to be some adjustments to the current system.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Orton.
I agree with what you've said, Mr. Chief Justice. There are folks, I believe, Senator Sharon, that are in this pool now. We have to address their legal questions to the program. But then Mr. Benson testified that there are folks that are currently incarcerated that could be in this lag time, where we should think it very important to address whether or not this program is going to continue and on what basis, because they will be affected by it. They're currently serving a criminal sentence, but could be very much affected by what options might be available later, and I think it is incumbent upon us to look at both.
Anything further in your presentation, Justice Magnuson?
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for your attention to this. It is a difficult issue, we hope that we can help you in addressing that when our next report comes out. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll look forward to the report. And thank you for your service as chair of the task force.
Thank you.
We'll now welcome Kelly Mitchell, the executive director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, to the table. Ms. Mitchell, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Sandra Latz. So I'm Kelly Mitchell, Executive Director of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and I'm going to try to address some of the questions that you had on the sentencing side of things today. So first of all, I just want to really quickly go over what the criminal sexual conduct offenses are. We currently have 5 degrees of criminal sexual conduct, with first degree being the most serious of those 5. And the different degrees break out on these factors, whether the offense involved sexual penetration or contact, the age of the victim, the relationship of the offender to the victim, the degree of injury or threat of injury, whether a weapon was involved, and whether force or coercion was involved. This is a really rough breakdown of those 5 degrees. It's a very, very rough breakdown. There's a lot of detail in these statutes. But generally, first-degree offenses involve penetration, personal injury or fear of great bodily harm, the use of a dangerous weapon. And generally, these offenses involve younger children under the age of 13. For those children, when you get to the age classification, that first degree applies regardless of whether there was injury, force, or weapons. Second degree offenses are similar to first degree offenses. The difference tends to be sexual contact versus sexual penetration. When we get down to third degree offenses, the focus shifts to children who are slightly older, above that age 13 mark, or if cases in which there was force or coercion. And this is where we see the inclusion of offenses perpetrated by psychotherapists, health professionals, clergy, and correctional employees. Fourth degree offenses are similar to third degree, but again, involve sexual contact rather than sexual penetration. And then there is a small category of fifth degree offenses that involves repeat violations of our gross misdemeanor sexual conduct offenses. So I just wanted to give you a little picture of what the volume of cases has been over time, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about the increases that we have made to sentences in this area. So here is a graph depicting just the volume of felony offenders convicted for criminal sexual conduct offenses going back to 1993. I'm afraid I don't know what caused the big drop in the early years, but we've our population has leveled out. From 2003 to 2011, we were consistently between about 550 and 600 offenders per year. We saw that drop a bit in 2012 to 544 offenders. This is the breakdown by degree. I mentioned earlier that fifth degree is a really small category, and they're so small you can't even see them on the graph here. So mostly what you're seeing are first through fourth degree offenses, and those proportions have been relatively stable over the years. I'd say most recently third degree was a little bit bigger proportion of the overall number of offenses, and that again dropped pretty significantly in 2012. We had 214 offenders in 2011, but only 184 convicted of third degree offenses in 2012. So to look a little bit at sentencing enhancements that have occurred over time, I'm going to focus on the 2000s. Now, there were a few changes that happened back in the 90s as well, but the majority of the enhancements that we've made to criminal sentencing occurred in this past decade. So in 2000, the year 2000, the legislature enacted a 144-month mandatory minimum sentence for first-degree criminal sexual conduct offenses. 2 years later, in 2002, the legislature enacted a 90-month mandatory minimum for second-degree criminal sexual conduct offenses. 2005, the legislature enacted Minnesota Statute 609.3455, and that statute did a number of things. It enacted mandatory life sentences for certain repeat and egregious first-time offenders. It increased the conditional release term from 5 to 10 years for most criminal sexual conduct convictions, and it created a lifetime conditional release term for repeat offenders and offenders sentenced to life. Now, in 2005, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, in submitting its annual report to the legislature, actually did recommend these life sentences, that they be enacted. And the goal there was to provide an indeterminate option for offenders who were considered to be the worst of the worst offenders. We also, that was also the year that the commission first suggested the idea of a separate sex offender grid. It wasn't quite ready to be published that year, so the legislature asked us to do some more work on it. And then that grid was enacted in 2006. So I did give everyone a copy of the sex offender grid, so you should have one in your packet. And just really quickly, in order to be sentenced on the grid, criminal history scores run across the top, severity levels run across up and down the sides. You find the severity level and the criminal history score that match up, and the sentence that's in that cell is your presumptive sentence. All of the offenses that are in the non-shaded portion of the grid are recommended prison, and all of the offenses that are in the shaded portion of the grid are recommended probation. So our most serious offenses, first and second degree, most of those fall into, first degree falls into severity level A, where all offenses are recommended to prison. Second and third degree, second and third degree criminal sexual conduct offenses involving force fall into severity levels B and C, and those are also all presumptive prison sentences. So there's a couple of things that are different about the way that this grid works compared to the standard sentencing guidelines grid. So first of all, one thing that's different is that the mandatory minimums that I mentioned earlier for first and second degree offenses are right on the grid at a criminal history score of zero. So you'll see for criminal sexual conduct in the first degree is at severity level A. At a criminal history score of zero, there's that 144 months that the legislature enacted. The other thing that's different is that for all of the first-degree offenses and for all of the second, third, and fourth-degree offenses that involve force, we've actually put the statutory maximum time that the legislature established on the grid at a severity level of six. So for first degree, if you follow it all the way out to six or more, you'll see 360 months, and that's the 30 years that the legislature has established as the maximum sentence for that crime. So most of the time on our grid, you don't get to that maximum sentence on the grid, on the standard grid, but here on the sex offender grid, you do get to that maximum sentence. The other thing that's different about how the grid works behind the scenes is that an offender is going to actually move across that criminal history score much more quickly than they might on the standard grid. And that happens in two ways. The first is that we've increased the weights for prior criminal sexual conduct offenses. So if you come in with a new offense and you have a criminal sexual conduct offense in your past, it's going to be weighted more heavily against you, and so that's going to result in higher criminal history score than you might otherwise have gotten. The other thing is, if you're under supervision for a criminal sexual conduct offense currently, when you commit a second or a subsequent offense, the guidelines require that you get two custody status points. Those are translated directly into criminal history points. So you move across that grid very quickly if you commit more than a single criminal sexual conduct offense. In 2006, the legislature also enacted the ingrained offender provision, and that allows the court to issue a sentence of double the presumptive guideline sentence for offenders who are a danger to the public and for whom the risk to reoffend is great without psychotherapeutic intervention. So that means the number that you see on the grid could be doubled if the right conditions are present. And then last year in 2013, the legislature reinstated the three-year mandatory minimum sentence for repeat offenders, and that requires an executed sentence of at least 36 months if the offender has a previous sex offense conviction. And that provision is really aimed at offenders who might fall into the shaded portion of the grid a second time if they commit a second offense, one of these lower-level offenses, more than once. So our grid might have them presumed to serve a probation sentence. This mandatory minimum says, no, it's got to be a prison sentence, and it's going to be a sentence for 3 years. So that's really the people that offense targets more closely. So all of these changes have resulted in a significant change in the range of sentences that are available for criminal sexual conduct offenders. So this grid, or this graph, shows what the minimum sentences were over time at a criminal history score of 0. And you can see that the area where the change has been the greatest are the more serious offenses, first and second degree. So, for instance, in 1988, the presumptive minimum sentence for a first-degree criminal sexual conduct offense was 43 months. That increased to 86 months in 1999. That was based on some legislative changes that happened in the early 90s. Then it went up to 144 months in 2005. That's after the enactment of the mandatory minimum sentence. And in 2012, here we are at 144 months. On the other end,
perhaps now is not the time to interrupt your presentation. We'll complete here, and then we have a question from one of the senators.
Okay. Thank you. So here's the other end. Here's the maximum sentence that is available. So I've shown you what you could do on the bottom end, and now this is the difference in the range, where you could get to. So in 1988, the maximum sentence you could impose for a first-degree sentence, this is the blue bar on the far right, was 132 months. Following a tweak in the legislative statutory maximum in the early 90s, by 1999, that number had moved up to 158 months. In 2005, after the enactment of the mandatory minimum, that number was still 158 months because we were already imposing higher sentences. And then by 2012, with the implementation of the sex offender grid, which actually put the statutory maximum on the grid, we're up to being able to impose the full 360 months for a first-degree criminal sexual conduct offense. So those are that's the range. That's your possibility. So the next slide shows what actually happened. What were the sentences that were actually imposed? And this slide adds a bar on the far right, which is now in sort of that dark pink, that shows the average the average sentence across all of the degrees. So what we saw is in 1988, I'm just going to focus on criminal sexual conduct in the first degree again. In 1988, the average sentence imposed was 75 months. Moving up to 1999, the average sentence imposed for first-degree crimes was 123 months. Now we get the mandatory minimum in place. By 2005, it's moved up to 150 months. Then we get the sex offender grid implementation, and by 2012, that number is 181 months. So we have made some significant changes that have ratcheted up the sentences that are issued for criminal sexual conduct offenders. And overall, the average has increased from 54 months to 128 months.
Thank you. Senator Dietzick?
Thank you. I have a question going back to the grid.
Yeah.
So in this shaded area with I think it was that what we did last year, maybe the three-year minimum. So, and then can you explain in this grid, so because it was convicted, so these are convicted, so if you're convicted, so it, as part of the criminal history score, if you weren't convicted, but you maybe pled before a conviction, if you plead down, does any of that other background, does pleading down, so you're considered, convicted at this lesser charge, but do we look at the original stuff when you're doing this whole criminal history? So how does that work? I don't know if I asked it correctly, but.
Ms. Mitchell?
Thank you, Senator Sharon and Senator Dietzick. The criminal history score is based on the actual crimes of conviction. So if the a prior offense was charged out at a higher level and then reduced, we're going to weight it at the level at which it was actually convicted. So we're not going to look at the offense conduct in that situation.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Mitchell, or Madam Chair, Ms. Mitchell. If I'm reading this right, if I'm looking at slides 12 and 13, in 2012, does this say that for first degree criminal sexual conduct, the anticipated sentence is 360 months, but the actual served was 181 months?
Ms. Mitchell.
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, what slide 12 shows is what the maximum possible sentence would be for that offense. So you'd have to be at a criminal history score of 6 to get 360 months. And what slide 13 shows is what the actual average sentence was for that offense. So we have a mix there of offenders who are at all criminal history scores for first degree. And so 183 is that average for all offenders on that line.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mitchell. Please continue.
Thank you. So I just wanted to quickly just also show, I mentioned a few of the sentencing enhancements that had been enacted over time, and I wanted to show the use of those since they've been enacted. So what this slide demonstrates is the use of the ability in law to issue a sentence that is double the presumptive sentence on the guidelines grid. And for the past over the past 3 years, that's been done 6 times. You'll see in 2010 that the presumptive sentences that were doubled were on the high end. They were, the blue shows that they ranged from about 140 to 160 months. And then the red bars show once you double it, then the sentence starts to approach 30 years. In 2011 and 2012, we had a couple of offenders who had lower-level offenses, but this provision to double their sentences was still utilized. It's just that they started out at a much smaller presumptive sentence based on their crime and their criminal history score. Over the past 3 years, we've had an additional 20 individuals who were not included on the slide that I showed you before who had sentences of 30 years or more. And I show you this because criminologists tend to refer to a 30-year sentence as sort of like the next alternative to a life sentence. It's a very long sentence. It ends up being a significant portion of the offender's life. And so the sort of light blue shade shows that the 30-year sentence was either the high end of the range for the individual or it was achieved through an aggravated departure, meaning that the judge actually imposed a sentence above the range that's shown on the grid. And the dark blue shows the number of offenders who received a 30-year sentence because that was their presumptive sentence. So that's indicating those new policies on the grid are actually getting people into the zone where 30 years is considered the appropriate sentence for their conduct. And then finally, this graph shows the issuance of life sentences. Now, I mentioned that life became a possibility in 2005. There's a lag. We had the question earlier about whether you could impose sentences on conduct that occurred in the past. And basically the way it works is once a sentence is created in law, it can only be then imposed on offenders from that point forward, whose crime occurred that date forward. And that's in your enabling legislation each time that you enact a new criminal provision. So 2006 was the first opportunity that we had where an offense was committed after the life provision was set in place. And since then, we've had 19 offenders who have received life sentences. Now, our statute allows two possibilities, either life with the possibility of release or life without the possibility of release. And we've had 5 offenders who've fallen into that category where they have life without the possibility of release, and the other 15 do have the possibility of release, and the statute basically requires the court to establish that initial point at which they could be considered, and the guideline sentence is the benchmark for that point in time. The very bottom of this also, we also looked at how many of these offenders reached that life sentence possibility because they had multiple offenses occurring and being sentenced in the same at the same time, or because they actually had a long history of prior offenses. So the orange in the bar shows that there were four offenders who didn't have prior offenses. So either their offense, they either had one offense that was so egregious that it qualified for life, or they committed multiple offenses that, fell into one prosecution. We had eight offenders who had one true prior offense, meaning that they were convicted and sentenced of that offense before this new crime occurred. We had five who had two prior criminal sexual conduct offenses, one who had three, and one who had four. So that's how they reached those life sentences. So the point of all of that was just to demonstrate that, to show you how sentencing has changed, that we are in a place where we have much more severe sentencing policies than we used to, and we are beginning to utilize the tools that have been given to the criminal justice system to incarcerate offenders that warrant it for a much longer period of time. The other thing I just want to mention, because I did say that sentencing is time sensitive. Once a new policy goes into place, your offense has to occur after that date in order for that sentencing option to apply to you. The GRID was enacted in 2006. In 2012, we finally reached a place where a majority of offenders are actually on this grid, meaning that their offenses occurred in 2006 or later. We had 91% of offenders who were convicted in 2012 actually were convicted off of the sex offender grid. The rest had offenses that were older and were still being sentenced under the old standard grid. So,
Senator Orban.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Mitchell, of the folks that get released, where did they predominantly go to these civil commitment programs?
Senator Latz, Senator Ortman, we don't actually have numbers that track who ends up in the civil commitment program. So, you know, that's really a determination that's made by the Department of Corrections. At that two-thirds point, they'll do their evaluation and they'll determine which offenders are appropriate for civil commitment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Orban.
Is it possible for us to ask for that information from the Department of Corrections? It'd be good to know where these folks get released to.
Sure. Someone from the Department of Corrections in the room here? Consider the question asked. I got a wave back. Thank you. I think, you know, it's important to note how sentences have ratcheted up substantially from the presentation that's here. And in answer to Senator Ortman's earlier queries about what to do with sentencing, I think that may help answer part of that as to does the Sentencing Guidelines Commission make any recommendations as to whether there ought to be any more steps taken, or does the commission, or can you say this anyway, that they feel there are satisfactory levels of tools in the toolbox now to deal with this particular population in terms of sentencing?
Senator Latz, the commission did the bulk of its work back in 2005. It really put out the policy that it believed at the time would be the most appropriate for sentencing. And it's sort of taken a hands-off approach since then. It will respond if there's a desire to change sentencing in this area. But right now, we don't have any plans to make any further recommendations for changes to the sentencing regime.
Because this really does, I think, address some of the concerns Senator Ortman and others have raised about whether or not there ought to be changes to the sentencing structure. As well. So sort of that input to the civil commitment process. Certainly it helps answer that question to some degree. Senator Dietzick.
Okay, so I just need to clarify here, again, back to this chart and then kind of on some of this other stuff. So if somebody were to commit a crime today that had a, you know, previous conviction prior to 2005, you don't have the life sentence option available to them or the 30-year option Am I hearing that correct? And so that may be some of the issue in between, why they didn't get some of the longer sentences.
Ms. Mitchell.
And now we have that option, if I'm hearing this right.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dietzick, yes, that's correct. So as I mentioned, in 2012, we still had 9% of offenders who committed their offense prior to the grid being enacted in 2006. So those offenders are being sentenced on the grid, on the standard guidelines grid that was in effect in 2005. In addition, the enhancements that the legislature enacted in 2005 wouldn't be available. Well, they might. It depends on exactly when the offense occurred in that year. But if they're prior to 2005, no, those enhancements would not be available. And I did mention too that so currently, if you go across all degrees, the average sentence is 128 months. So that means that any change that might be put into place in sentencing today would take about 10 years for us to see, you know, the impact on the inflow to the civil commitment population, because they'd have to get through that sentence first before they'd be eligible for civil commitment.
May I try to clarify something from Senator Dietz's question? I think you answered a slightly different question.
Okay.
As I heard her question, correct me if I'm wrong, Senator, but you asked about the impact of an old prior on sentencing for a current offense. And your answer had to do with an old current offense, if you will. In other words, some people that may have committed their offense back in 2004, but for one reason or another were never brought into custody, had a trial or pled, convicted, and are being sentenced now. So maybe they escaped from justice for a while and they got caught on a warrant in Arkansas after 10 years on the lam. And so now they're being sentenced for a crime that occurred at a time when an old sentencing guidelines were in effect. But your question specifically was, what if they got a prior from 2003 and they committed a new offense? Now, as I understand it, they would be sentenced under today's current sentencing guidelines grid, okay, and that prior would count as a criminal history score factor.
Okay, so, hers was helpful, but that's what I was getting at. If you have somebody that had, maybe they had a low-level fifth degree, so they've gotten out, or they were just had, presumptive somewhat probation, and then they came back and so the original one was prior to 205, and then they came back and reoffended. They still can go by this. It's the current offense. It's through here.
Is that right,
priors,
Ms. Mitchell?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dietzick, yes, I apologize for misunderstanding your question. Yes, not only would they be sentenced on the new grid because their offense falls within that, their old prior would receive a greater weight now than it might have if they'd reoffended sooner. So they're actually going to end up with a higher criminal history score today than they might have if the sex offender grid had not been enacted.
Senator Sharon.
And just to make sure it's correct in my mind, did I hear you say, that because of the existing sentencing guidelines, should they change today, that because the average length of stay across all levels of offenses is at least 10 years, that we have 10 years of already convicted persons that we are needing to plan for, whether it's through a civil commitment process or being released directly from the prison system?
Ms. Mitchell.
And that wouldn't change unless they commit a new offense, then they would be sentenced under new law.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, yes. As my colleague Robin Vue Benson mentioned, there's a lag time. So even if they're sentenced today, they have to get through that sentence before they be considered for civil commitment. So any changes that you make to that sentencing regime, even if it increases the sentences, you're going to have to wait a long time to get to the point in time where you're looking at that person going into civil commitment. In the meantime, all of the offenders who've been sentenced under our current policy are working their way through the system, and they'll be getting out at the two-thirds point. So really what we're dealing with going into civil commitment is the population that may have been sentenced under old sentencing policies or who's being sentenced currently today.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
So then there are those folks that were sentenced prior to what is our current legislative sentencing guideline. And so they may have had a much shorter sentence and now are heading towards release and potentially civil commitment. And those are the ones I'm most concerned about.
But to a point that was made earlier, is we can't change current sentences now to affect that population.
Well, Mr. Chair, not their sentence, but we can certainly change what programs are available for their release.
That's right.
Right, and that's what Senator Sharon was saying earlier as well.
Right.
That's got to be that's the task force's primary focus as well, and that certainly has to be our focus. Whatever we decide to do on sentencing, it won't affect this particular population.
Well, Mr. Chair, we also could affect what happens to those folks sentenced after 2005 and what options are available to them. I mean, there's the whole range of everybody in this lag time that we should be looking at, in my view.
Yeah. Well, in terms of release, what happens when they reach that two-thirds point and are being released? What then? And that we certainly can have an immediate impact on that. We had anticipated a fair, time anyway for discussion among the committee. We've had a fair amount of it along the way here, but I do want to open up the floor and see if there's any other thoughts or comments members of the committee want to make, or questions they want to ask of any of the panelists or anyone else, frankly, who's in the room, as long as we're on the topic, because we have an opportunity to talk about that.
Well, I could begin the conversation. I tend to break things into segments, and in the way I organize it so I can keep track of it. So I do think there's a variety of things that the legislature needs to address. One is, we have a letter in front of us from NCASA about the importance of sexual violence prevention or violence prevention in general. I think that's a whole subject matter that needs to be addressed by the legislature. And I think sentencing guidelines and the whole discussion around, do we address sex offenders strictly through a Department of Corrections process, or primarily, and still leave some civil commitment for the worst of the worst, or whatever that gets defined to be, or do we eliminate it as 30 other states said? That's another conversation about what we might do, and changing the sentencing guidelines might be a part of that conversation. But then there is this court case, and there is the existing system, and so that's another silo that I think about that I think really creates for us an urgency to demonstrate sincerity to the federal court, that we've heard what their concerns are and that we create a response to that that's legitimate in relationship to not using civil commitment to extend sentences. So I know that Judge Magnuson has never tried to presume to say what the court will do, I do hope that in those various segments that we break ourselves down into work groups and move forward legislation in all of those areas, including changing maybe the criteria that we use for civil commitment in the first place. There's multiple questions that that need to be responded to in relationship to our overall approach to dealing with sex offenders. But I don't want to let all of, not that I don't think they are important, but when those things can get confused and confabulated in a way that we avoid as a legislature addressing the really complex and highly politicized conversation about the existing sex offenders, the 700 or so in Moose Lake or St. Peter, and those that for at least 10 years, and probably more because it takes a while to change, that will be being released from the corrections department. That really has to have a high priority, that we take some time to come up with a rational response to what I think has been the federal court's generosity to allow us some time to be responsive to what they're saying is a questionable constitutionality.
I think it's incumbent on us to step up to the plate now. to encourage our colleagues in the other body to step up to the plate with the same seriousness of mind and purpose as we intend to in the Senate, so that we can address this spring, because we don't have the luxury of a lot of time to deal with it now. Senator Plummer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't say it's been my pleasure to serve on the task force, because it's been very complicated and tiring to go over the same subject, and this type of subject is one that certainly is not one that is always pleasant to review. But on the same hand, if you enjoy the challenge of public policy making, proper, good, constitutional policy making, this is a target-rich environment. And one thing that I would like to remind those who haven't really gotten into this, and we've heard it, it's complex, it's complicated, it's got a lot of different avenues one can stray into, and one needs to stay focused. Something like what Senator Sharon said, stay segmented a bit or compartmentalized as you focus on it. But about a year before the majority shift, we in the Republican Party was, not party, but the caucus, was just beginning to tiptoe into this area, and we had some preliminary examinations of the systems. And during that time, there were three basic areas that we began to focus on as we compartmentalized our focus. One was constitutionality. We anticipated there would be legal action, despite comment from others in state government that would never happen. Second, the role and the perception. The perception has to be a reality that public safety must be satisfied. And then the whole, one of the other major focuses was the costs involved. The cost of the present civil commitment process per individual, per capita, is about 300 to 400% more expensive than a Department of Corrections approach. And so it gets very, very costly, and if you see the pattern of escalation of that population, this system is going to become extremely expensive if we continue, even if it wasn't without the nudging of the federal courts, to alter our path a bit. And so as I've come to study this area, and I have to urge, and I've said it publicly before, please let's not make this political. It's a tremendous temptation for all of us, those of us especially, those that are running for election in this upcoming year. It's very tempting, but I think the better interest of our state and the people would be better served if we ask serious questions, make serious proposals, and have the public debate without the political opportunities to be engaged. The last thing that anyone wants to see is a federal court coming in with what has been characterized as a broadsword to fix our problem simply due to the fact that we fail to fix our problem. And they've given us, grabbed our attention. They want us to repair, alter our path, and I think it's the public is best served when we do our job. And believe me, there's plenty of other political opportunities out there to take advantage of one another and sell our case to the public. But I think it's better served if we knuckle down, stay focused, and this one, we should take a political truce on it and just let's get this issue behind us. Because it's too costly, and the last thing anyone wants is to have inadvertently someone released due to a court order when they shouldn't be. There's no halfway house in between the public and that individual. There'll be no counselor on a 24/7. There'll be no GPS bracelet on that individual. And if that person is truly a threat, we don't want them released in that manner.
Senator Lads.
Senator Sherman.
I had my say, but I failed to say, and I meant to, just to affirm what Senator Limmer is saying. I meant to say that I thought that we worked really well together in the last session to pass the legislation, even though it wasn't completely comprehensive. It did have the potential to demonstrate to the court that we were sincere in listening to what they were saying and trying to find a way that we could rationally determine how to sustain our public safety given some reality of some risk and improve the constitutionality of our system. And I just wanted to say to you, Senator Limmer, and to Senator Hahn and other leaders in the Republican caucus, that it would not have happened without your leadership, and that I think we demonstrated that around a subject like this that we can be really focused on the policy and good public outcome for the public when we work well together, as we did on this legislation. So I appreciate that.
Maybe I'll just highlight the alternative. If we fail to work together and achieve a bipartisan consensus result, I think we will all be rightfully blamed for abdicating our responsibilities as elected officials as well. And we'll have only ourselves to blame for that. So I'm confident that this committee and the members of the Senate can achieve that level of discourse and results. And I'm hopeful that as a whole legislature that can be accomplished as well in this year. I think we're going to have to address it this year because the court's not going to wait forever for us to do our job. Any other comments or thoughts before we adjourn? Well, I want to thank all of you for your attention and your time today and the presentations. We will move forward from here. I look forward to seeing all of you at a January hearing together with the Human Services Committee. We are now adjourned.